The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Hello, I'm Barney Ronay. Welcome to our Guardian Open Weekend Cricket Podcast. Part of a weekend of events dedicated to showcasing our open approach to all forms of journalism. So open, in fact, that we've even started giving complete novices such as myself the opportunity to host live events. Whatever could possibly go wrong. Thanks to our audience for coming. I have to say, when I first heard that we were recording a podcast in front of the Guardian's cricket reading community, I'd expected to find myself in a room full of wisdom fetishists carrying satchels who all look slightly angry. At this point, I had planned to say something like, imagine my surprise coming in here, but I think looking around will just draw a veil over that. And it's probably time to introduce our guests in the pod today. Starting on my right, a left-handed batsman of imposing stature, a man who set the tone for so many Ashes series of the 1990s and 2000s, dominating every kind of bowling. And Matthew Hayden was some player. And one man who played against him many times is our special guest today, Mark Butcher. Mark, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Mark, of course, played 71 test matches for England, scored over 4,000 test runs, and retired in 2009 after a 17-year first-class career spent at the Oval. Next to Mark is Ian Pryor, our sports editor, and there'll be a chance to ask Ian some questions later on, particularly, I hope, about our coverage of county cricket.
Or lack of it. Is that what you're alluding to?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Fine county blog.
Innovating, I think you'll find.
Yeah, innovative is the word. And we'll, of course, be covering all the big issues ahead of a very exciting season. Mark, maybe a quick word with you first on England, given that we're on the verge of a slightly bizarre, shortened two-test series with no one-day international. So the main thing people are talking about is a batting order, which has had a bit of a shake-up. Who would be your top six?
Well, if it was down to me, Matt Pryor would be batting at number six. Right. And that the whole, would it be Ravi Bapara, would it be Samit Patel argument would be moot. Number one, because I believe Sri Lanka is the toughest place bar none to play cricket anywhere in the world. It's unbelievably hot, unbelievably humid. And to go into any match lasting more than 50 or 60 overs without five bowlers, for me, is a huge mistake. I think Matt Pryor is a fantastic batsman in his own right, let alone the fact that he does such a great job with the gloves. And that would allow England then to play somebody like Tim Bresnan, who I think is more than capable.
Would he be number seven?
Yeah, he'd bat the number seven. So England would then have three quicks and play the two spinners in in Panesar and Swan. Complete, and that's a waste of time. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. I think the fact that Ravi now he's got a back injury, we've heard. I don't know if that's terminal, but I think the fact that he is now out in terms of bowling will mean that Samit Patel will make his debut. I think, and he's a very, very fine player on those types of pitches against spin bowling, of which England are going to face plenty, as they did in Pakistan. So I don't have any issues with him playing. He bowls more than handy left-arm spin as well, which will come in very useful when the pitch goes, or when the ball gets tired after about seven overs. Bad luck again on Ravi, that he seems to be dogged with either, you know, being preferred to other players or injury, and he doesn't seem to be able to get his test career back underway again. But I think Samit Patel will make a test debut tomorrow.
It's interesting. I wonder when the last time England played three spinners and two seam bowlers in a... There's probably someone in the audience who knows the answer to that, but I certainly don't.
No, I can't think of a time. Well, I mean, England have always been very reticent to play more than one spinner, as it is. So to have three of them in there would be something of a miracle. I really and truly, looking at what you would like to happen, if the game goes perfectly, you win the toss, you bat first and the pitch deteriorates, I would very much like to have... I'd have my two best spin bowlers, but I'd also have that extra seam bowler. And Bresnan, for me, is England's best reverse swing bowler, and we might see that happen if the pitch is very dry over there too.
Mark, do you think goal is somewhere that they'll just be happy to get out of alive? I mean, their last three tests there, an England's defeat, the
by very much the worst of a draw, and they got away, and I think rain saved them the other time. You know, it's a really nasty place to play, certainly if you're England.
It is tough, but in a two-match series, you can't afford to lose it, can you? You've got to go there and win that test match. I think, you know, I played a test series in Sri Lanka in 2000, I think it was 2003, the winter, and we got away from Gaul with a draw and, you know, with bad light stopping play with us nine down, you know, hung on by the skin of our teeth. Having said that, they had Muralitharan in the side then, and Chaminda Vass, two very, very fine bowlers in any conditions. Sri Lanka don't have that anymore in terms of their bowling attack. It's not as formidable. You take Murali out of it, and they come a long way back to the pack, even in their own conditions. So I think England still, as long as they bat well enough, as long as they put 400 runs on the board the first time they bat, then they should be in a very good position to go out there and try and overturn a very tough team in tough conditions.
It should be actually a lot easier for England's top six compared to the Pakistan series in the UAE, where, I mean, Ajmal is a genuine quality spinner, and those pitches seem to suit him, that kind of zippy spin bowling. Yeah. This Sri Lanka attack, I mean, it doesn't really compare, does it?
No, I mean, their spinners are, is it Randiv, off spinner, and Herath, who's the left arm spinner, who's played a bit over in England. I think he even played for Surrey.
He played for Surrey last season, didn't he?
Yeah, and without, you know, really setting the world on fire.
And Mendes, who comes and goes whenever.
I don't think he'll play. I think he's very much out of favour for them. So their attack is much more workmanlike now. So, and England will have learned a lot of lessons about, obviously, about the DRS, about playing spin, about making sure that they've got more of a game plan or understanding about what they're coming up against before this series. So, you know, I hopefully, touch wood, it will be a better showing than it was back in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai.
What was it like? I mean, facing Murali on his home patch like that.
It wasn't a lot of fun.
Did you have any, you know, was there any kind of credible strategy? Were you just hanging in there? Were you ever tempted to take him on?
Well, yeah, I mean, you had to gamble every once in a while. I mean, going back to Gaul, I think I made a couple of half centuries in the first test, both of which took an extraordinary amount of time. You know, 3.5 hours. You'd expect, you know, if you'd batted that long in England, you'd expect to be close to 100. But just crept over 50 in 3.5 hours and was seeing pink elephants by that stage, and you just lost so much fluid, and you know, and against Muralitharan, you're very much along the lines of, you know, you're trying to use your pad quite a lot, you get down the pitch if you possibly could, you didn't have to worry about the DRS, which obviously now is
how many wickets would he have got with that?
You know, he got what did he get, 800 in the end? He'd have had 1200 comfortably if there'd been a DRS system back then. So it would have been a lot more difficult now. However, it was pretty damn difficult then. So, you know, I think England will, having been through what they've been through in Dubai, they will have a much better idea and understanding of what they can and can't do. And one of the things about going on tour in the subcontinent, as a batsman in particular, is you have to play differently. You can't take up the same guard, take up the same stance and do things exactly as you would do at home, because that's how you've been scoring millions of runs. It requires a shift in terms of how you're going to approach the ball, which guards you're going to take, whether or not you're going to bend your knees a little bit more, get your feet a little bit further apart, make an earlier movement, etc., etc. You do actually have to factor in a totally different way of approaching your batting and scoring runs in those conditions. And England didn't do that in Dubai.
Did that surprise you that they didn't do that? Because if you look at Andy Flower, I mean, fantastic player of spin, you know, former England batting coach, and that they've got Graham Gooch too, but yet it seemed to take them, I mean, they were three tests down before they woke up.
Well, I wonder, and I don't know this for a fact, but I wonder whether or not, you know, you become victims of your own success to a certain extent. Most of the batsmen going into that series hadn't failed in a test match series for a couple of years. Most of them, without wanting to sound churlish, hadn't faced a decent spin bowler for 2 years either. Mm. I mean, you know, to play five test matches in Australia and not face a single bloke who can bowl spin for five test matches is extraordinary. Mm. So perhaps, you know, you go in there and your confidence is very, very high, but you're not quite in tune to what the next challenge is going to be. And Syed Ajmal is as good a bowler as you're going to come up against. You know, you go back to the likes of sort of Sack Lane and Murali himself and Warne, etc. He's an artist in that bracket, and England haven't played against a decent spin bowler for quite some time.
Any questions for you about against England's middle order? Have they still got a lot of credit stored up?
Oh yeah, plenty. For me, it was simply a case of not being ready enough. Mm-hmm. And then once they realised that, it was too late to try and claw it back. Mm. But I don't think we'll see them. I don't think we'll see them suffer in quite the same way as we did before.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got some. Would we want to go with these questions now? We've got some questions from the audience. I'll put these to our panel. Do we think it affected England's performance to play in front of such tiny crowds in Dubai and Abu Dhabi? Or is that unimportant? I mean, it's true, there wasn't a Barmy Army presence out there, basically because it's a dry state and there doesn't seem to be that much in it for them.
Surely it's one thing that a good schooling in county cricket would prefer you for.
Well, exactly. This is what I thought all along. Right? It's quite too jarring for these guys. They've been playing it, indeed.
No, that's my answer entirely, yeah. We're more than used to that, playing in April in county cricket. As I said, I simply think it was a case of them not really being ready for what was going to hit them.
And it's a quality attack, wasn't it? I mean, because Raymond, the left arm, was a quality bowler.
Yeah.
And Umar Gul. I mean, if you gave them back a couple of bowlers they've lost to the legal process, that would be a hell of an attack, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it very very different conditions as well. I mean, people will be talking about Sri Lanka, there being slow pitches and the ball turning. But what you see over there is the ball will turn, but it will turn sideways. Whereas over there in Dubai and Pakistan, the pitches were a little bit more sort of like this, so the ball skidded. And when it did spin, it spun a tiny little bit, but did it at real pace. And the ball never really bounced above stump height either. So every time you missed it, you were gone, you were dead. In Sri Lanka, you'll see the ball grip and turn. It'll turn slower, it'll turn more sideways, but it'll go slower and it'll bounce more. So the DRS may not come into play quite so much with batsmen on the front foot because balls will be going over the top of the stumps. Mm. And you'll see more catches behind the wicket. You know, in Pakistan, there were very few catches behind the wicket because the ball didn't bounce high enough to take the edge. It just skidded straight through and went on to hit the stump.
I've got another question here from the audience. This is from Josh, who's from Leeds. It's a question that, I mean, I can only see one answer to this. Who do we think might be the next England captain after Andrew Strauss, who's obviously not getting any younger and isn't on a great run of form? I mean,
there's only one man for it, isn't there?
Yeah, you'd think it would be the one-day international captain at the moment. I mean, I suppose Stuart Broad would have a claim being an England captain in another format. It'd probably be out of those two, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think we're already... When the three captains idea was mooted after the World Cup, for me it was an odd decision, obviously, because Alistair Cook wasn't even in the team, wasn't even in the side. And since then he's proven beyond any doubt whether he should be in the 50 over side. But then also the idea that Stuart Broad was then going to be made the captain of the 2020 side, and we're already seeing it now that Broad has an injury doubt before the test match. Now he's a quick bowlers happen to get injured because it's a tough and nasty and frankly stupid job. But for me you don't want to have your captain being a guy that could very easily miss a test match or two test matches just by virtue of being out there doing his job.
I have to say, I mean, I thought the three captains idea was a slightly bizarre one, but towards the end of that UAE tour where Broad came in as 2020 captain, there was a notable stepping up. There was a new guy in, fresh ideas. I mean, that could have tailed off quite a lot, but his style seems to be to have a very young, athletic England team, and there was a real upturn at the end of the tour, and I was quite impressed with him, actually. I thought he really had something there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Alistair, you could say the same for Alistair Cook. You know, they won one day series comfortably, didn't they?
He's a hell of a cricketer, isn't he?
He is. I mean, extraordinary.
Do not underestimate him. No. He seems to have sort of limitless powers at the moment to kind of improve.
Yeah, and he's still young and still getting better. So,
all the time. You just think too. I mean, one of the key things about the whole England Renaissance that started with Fletcher and Hussain has been that the captain has always been that figure of immense solidity in the England team, you know, and you look through that team and however much Broad might bring a lot of spark, I mean, you just wonder, you know, when you've been in the field for 8 hours in Chandrigarh and you're looking at 500-600 on the board, is that really the man you want to get you out of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think he's a young man with an enormous amount of promise, but he also thinks about the game. It's obviously been in the family, and I know what it was like to have a father that played the game. It just gets into your blood, so you have perhaps more of an insight or more insights into it than somebody else who perhaps has come to it a bit later on. But I just think it's fraught with danger to have to have captains as quick bowlers. It doesn't mean they can't be good captains. It's just, you know, you're just running the risk of forever having to have a vice captain in charge of the side.
Plus, England like to rotate their bowlers a bit, which will be difficult if one of them's the captain. Should we ask the audience? Has anyone got a candidate other than Cook or possibly Broad for next England captain?
Any votes for Swan? I don't think so.
KP would do it, yeah, definitely do it.
Swan might be England Shane Warne, in the sense that they said Warne was the best captain Australia never had, and it does seem as though he would have been a marvellous captain. Yeah. And Swan, I forget, he captained one match, didn't he, because everybody else was injured, and he did very well there. And I think he is the sort of person, I think he would be a very good captain. He does seem to know a lot about the game, obviously different style from the others, but I don't think he'll ever get the chance. I wonder what the panel thinks.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think in terms of in terms of tactical acumen or a different way of looking at things, he would be very, very good. But I think one of the things that shouldn't be overlooked in terms of captaincy is to have somebody along the lines of an Andrew Strauss or an Alistair Cook who are constant people who are not sort of up and down. They don't their emotions don't run away with them. You can feel whatever you like on the inside, but on the outside, it pays to be, if you're going to be leading a team, particularly in places where it gets to 90-odd% humidity, you want guys who are going to be able to keep a lid on it and keep their cool and maintain, and keep the side in an even keel. You can't afford to have, you know, people who are like this or who are up and down in terms of their emotional content.
But it's quite an important role in the team that Swan has. I mean, that's quite nice to have somebody around who's a bit of a loose cannon.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to Andrew Flintoff being given the captaincy for the Ashes in 2000, the ill-fated Ashes tour in 2006. Now, my opinion on that the whole time was that, you know, people were saying, well, you know, he's England's best player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, that's his role. His role is to be England's best player and their talisman on the field. He doesn't need to be the captain to do that. Mm. You know, you can still do that without the stripes. We know Freddie's magnificent player, magnificent character to have around the dressing room. But in terms of that constancy of his emotions and of his, of his thought processes, etc., Andrew Strauss was streets ahead of him then, in terms of being able to keep things on a more even keel.
I think the remarkable thing was they followed that up with the brief and disastrous stint with KP, which, whatever you think about how that ended and the departure of the coach and his sacking, Peterson was just never going to be that man. He was never going to be the kind of figure for stability and solidity and, the calm head going forward. And I think that the successive kind of calamities in the captaincy stung them rather badly, and it's something there will be a kind of historical overhang for quite some time whenever they appoint a new captain.
Okay, well, let's move on and talk about the exciting summer of cricket that we've got coming up after this two-test tour, which will be over very quickly, and county season starts effectively on the 31st of March, doesn't it, with the game in the UAE, which I think Mark Ramprakash is captaining.
What's that? It's the MCC versus the champion county,
that's right,
isn't it?
The now traditional curtain raiser of the last 2 years. Beyond that, of course, the first kind of engagement for the England team will be West Indies coming here to play some tests and I think also some one-day internationals.
Three tests, isn't it?
Yeah. Which is actually a more intriguing series, as far as I'm concerned, than it might have been the last few times they've been over here. I think this is quite an interesting West Indies team. I mean, like me, many of you, and I'm sure you guys would have grown up on watching the fantastic West Indian teams. And I mean, Mark, you played against them. And the steep decline from that time is kind of quite striking. You played in the 2001 series, didn't you?
I played in a series in the West Indies in 97-98, which I think we lost 3-1. Walsh and Ambrose were still playing, and then England won famously at home in 2001, didn't they? And then the first time, then I was part of, which was one of my favourite moments as an England player, was beating the West Indies in the West Indies for the first time in, I think it was 36 years.
It was 2004.
So those were the series against them, and it's startling, but the thing that's always been most startling to me is I tend to look at it the other way around in terms of West Indies cricket. That if you think of it in terms of how incredible it was that a bunch of disparate islands with very, very small populations were the world champions of a sport for 20 years, and that, you know, if you look at somewhere like Barbados, you had four of the best cricketers in the world at that time that lived within three streets of each other. That it was astonishing that they were so brilliant, and that we shouldn't get too upset about the fact that they haven't been able to maintain that forever, and let's hope they come again. But I think that to celebrate the achievement rather than worry about what's gone wrong since is the way to look at the West
Indies. I think it's that romance, isn't it, and the fact of cricket, as I mean, the West Indies basically doesn't exist outside of cricket. That kind of idea of unifying these islands, giving them a presence, is, I think, why the West Indies are most people's sort of second team. I mean, there is a sense of the borders seem to be getting back together. Chris Gayle, he might be here this summer. Do we feel there might be a West Indies cricket revival around the corner? That's a question from the audience.
In a way, I mean, I kind of regret the days when the, you know, the loss of the days when the West Indies were the main series of the summer. And I think that 2001 series remains one of my favourite all-time England series,
yeah,
just for the sheer drama of it. And, you know, you can quite safely argue that they haven't quite been at the standard for a few years now, where they're justifying that stretch in July or August. But there always seems something fatally cruel about that. You know, when it's Windies or Bangladesh in that first series of the summer, and they're sent up. Are they going to Durham this year? Does anyone know?
I'm sure they'll be sent.
Nothing against Durham, but an April or early May test there, you know, is always a chasing for a visiting team from that part of the world, no matter what. You know, and it always, to me, starts the summer on quite a bum note.
See, I've got sort of a theory, my own theory, that I think actually the IPL, which is much maligned, might actually be a fairly decent thing for West Indian cricket, because there are already a few players, for example Andre Russell, who've got contracts there and who seem to respond to the pull of that, and he's playing in their test team now. Cricket is suddenly a viable career. I mean, a lot of West Indian players used to come to county cricket and have a career there, and in a kind of truncated way the IPL offers a kind of incentive to play the game. Is there anything in that?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's interesting you make the comparison between you know, deciding to go and play in the IPL or coming over and playing 6 months of county cricket. And which one you would decide to do as an 18-year-old.
But thinking more about kids, I mean, there's a draw.
I'm with you there. However, you know, there's very little in terms of comparison, is there? You go and do 6 weeks in the IPL playing a couple of 20-20 matches a week, or you bowl 1,000 overs in the county cricket and get paid the same money. Or which one am I going to do? You know, there's not much of a choice there. But yeah, I think you're right that it's good that that West Indies cricketers perhaps are being exposed to the outside influences of players, international players from other countries, just to see how other people go about it and what makes a successful career. I think, you know, the likes of sort of Dwayne Bravo, Darren Bravo, Kieran Pollard, etc., the fellas that if West Indies cricket is going to drag itself up from where it's got to, that it's these senior players that are going to have to really drive that culture through, and try and drag the younger players up and along with them.
It's interesting you mentioned Darren Bravo. He's a really fine young batsman. He's something of the Brian Lara, Mark Butcher kind of left-handed. one question: who was the best West Indian you played against?
Kirtley Ambrose is the best bowler I played against. Full stop. Mm-hmm. Coming from anywhere. And Brian Lara will always be my, you know, the question is always Tendulkar or Lara for me. It's Lara, hands down. Left-handed bias, probably.
Mm-hmm. Was that just the joy of watching him?
Yeah, I think there was something for watching Sachin Tendulkar is, you know, marvellous. You just kind of watch the precision of it and that will and the drive to go out there and break record after record. With Brian Lara, it was always something a little bit more dangerous than that. You know, there was an artistry to it, and the way he moved, the way he picked the bat up miles above his head, the way his feet weren't always near the pitch of the ball, there was something slightly more exciting about watching him go out and make 120, 150 in a side that perhaps wasn't a very good one a lot of the time, and you know, I'd watch that over Sachin any day.
I think England might be surprised a bit by this. I think there's a very fine West Indian pace attack coming here. Just looking at some of the names, I mean, Fidel Edwards is playing Test cricket again. Kemal Roach is a very fast bowler. Jerome Taylor, Andre Russell. Do you think they've got a chance of? I mean, have England faced bowlers like that? recently?
Again, you know, the difference between facing them in you know, playing in May, June, you know, over in England requires a certain amount of discipline and a certain amount of metronomic accuracy. Now, I played against Tino Best and Fidel Edwards in that series in 2004, and I reckon at the Test match in Jamaica where Steve Harmison took 7 for 12, the spells that I faced from both Edwards and Tino Best were the quickest. Quickest thing for an hour and a half of getting absolutely bombed to hell was the quickest thing I'd ever seen.
The Edwards bouncer, how was that?
Which one?
Well, didn't he have a very slingy bouncer?
Yeah, very slingy. Very, very quick. Really, really quick. Quick pitch at Jamaica. And, you know, compelling viewing for... I remember my old man called me after that night and I was black and blue. I got bruises everywhere. And he said, you know what? He said, I was listening to it on the radio, and he said, that sounded like the best Test cricket that I have ever not seen. And I said, well, yeah, it might have sounded bloody good from where you were. And he said, and you know what? That Jack Bannister on the radio, he said, all he could talk about was how slow the bloody over rate was.
Probably a relief. Are any thoughts from the audience looking forward to seeing the West Indies?
Just for the moment, we're number one in the world, but you're already there lamenting the sort of the dearth of West Indian cricket and, I don't know, perhaps Australian cricket. I can't imagine the Australians doing that. They'd be dancing on the grave of the West Indies cricket. They'd be dancing on the grave of our cricket and laughing out loud. You know, do you think that shows a lack of ruthlessness in the English character?
Do you know what? I genuinely don't think it does. Had it been the case that, you know... those sort of beatings from West Indies sides were so fresh in the mind. You've been in, you know, had it been the 2001 series, but to, you know, 2001 is 11 years ago now, and you could argue that was the, you know, certainly the last series they played here where you felt there were anything like a credibly dangerous Test team. So, certainly in terms of coming here,
there were a different prospect
over there, you know. But I think, you know, for those of us and a lot of people in this room who grew up watching that team and appreciating cricket through the medium of that team, you know, 10 years on, and even now only barely showing signs of any kind of a revival, that is a genuinely sad thing. I think Australia, you see a lot less tears shed for.
I must admit, I'm with you though, because I remember all those beatings through the 80s, you know, and nobody was crying for England when we were getting done 5-0 every time. So I, you know, you take the success when you can, don't you?
Question over there.
I just wanted to say, you asked about Lara v Tendulkar, and I saw Lara at the Oval the day after he got his 500. I'm not sure if Mark Butcher was playing then.
I got him out.
Ah, well done. So, do you want to say about that, and then I'll say what I was... All I was going to say was, I mean, he scored about... He didn't get 100, he got about 85, but I don't think I've ever seen batting like it. It was almost as though he had... the ball was always exactly between the fielders. He bisected the field every time. It was as though he had his compasses and things, and it was just, you know, it was as though it was a bowling machine at 40 miles an hour, stationary fielders, see if you can hit it between them. It was just incredible. Mm. Now, Mark, tell us how you got him out.
Well, in the first innings...
it was a one-day match.
OK, well, I think we may move on now. The main course of the summer, of course, is England playing South Africa, which I think is a series everybody's really looking forward to. It's mainly, I think, at the second half of August and September, so post-Olympics and so on. I think everybody's hoping it will be a really big cricketing summer. I think most people see these as the top two Test teams in the world. And South Africa are an extremely potent pace attack. I mean, how do you see that going, Mark?
It's going to be a great series. I mean, whatever happens in the next, you know, the next 2 or 3 weeks, it will be number one versus number two. South Africa, as you say, have got an extraordinarily potent quick bowling attack, and batsmen who are very hungry for scoring big runs. So they're in many ways perfectly matched to England. How do I see it going? I think home advantage will play a big part. And that I hope we squeak it. I think it's only four Test matches, isn't it, the series?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think it will be decided by a single test match.
How would you rate the attacks against each other? I mean, I'd say South Africa in Steyn have a bowler who's probably the best in the world, yeah. But England are maybe more consistent. I mean, we don't know much about Philander in this country.
Well, I saw a lot of him in the series against Australia, both in South Africa and the return series, and it's kind of come from nowhere really. He had a little bit of a go as a one day bowler for South Africa about 18 months ago. And was discarded, and now suddenly he's come back and takes five for every time he straps his boots on. Yeah. And he's very much he's kind of a Bresnan type bowler, you know, bustling, not express pace, but quick enough, and bowls a very tight line. And
they're calling him Vern McGrath, aren't they?
Vern McGrath, yeah. He's handy, and they've got a number of guys who are Albie Morkel, not Albie Morkel, Morning. His brother. Morning Morkel is just starting to come back into some form. He's kind of lost his wicket-taking ability a little bit, but he's coming back into it. They've stuck by him. And as you say, Dale Steyn is fantastic. They like to do the same as us. They like to play four bowlers when the conditions suit and pack the batting. And it'll be a very, very tight series, I think.
A chance to see the greatest player of the age as well, Jacques Kallis.
Mm.
Probably on his last tour here.
Yeah. You'd hope so, wouldn't you? You'd hope so.
How did the audience see that series going? Anyone from South Africa coming over here and proving their number one? We think it'll be England. 2-1 to England. Mm. Yeah, home advantage is probably quite important. Do you think the South African batting might be a little bit vulnerable? I see Jacques Rudolph is at number six now for them.
Yeah, he's been jumping up and down the order like a yo-yo. He's coming over to play. Coming over to play for Surrey in the first part of the summer just to get himself in good nick on our pitches, which is always nice. But possibly. One thing about the South African batting is in AB de Villiers and Jacques Kallis, you've got two guys. Jacques Kallis is now starting to play. The last 2 years or so, he's really starting to play in a much freer fashion. You know, I think he's always had the reputation. One of the reasons why he's never put up there is bracketed.
Younger all the time,
right.
Doesn't he?
He's never bracketed with the likes of Tendulkar and Lara is because of the fact that people feel that he's quite stodgy and that he doesn't really go out and dominate. He's a very fine technical batsman but makes his runs at his own pace. But certainly in the last two or three series that I've seen him, he's kind of played with a lot more freedom, I think, which shows that he trusts the other batsmen in the lineup a bit more. And perhaps also shows that he's getting towards the end and he's decided, sod it, it's about time I enjoyed myself a bit. and he now is starting to put pressure on opposition bowling attacks by scoring at the sort of rate that we've seen England score in the last 18 months or so.
Mark, do you think there's an argument that South Africa is actually the series England look forward to most? I mean, it doesn't have that kind of demonic intensity of an Ashes. It's not like, I mean, India is always a home or away thing, you know. But South Africa, they always seem to meet on reasonably equal terms down the years. You know, they're always extraordinarily competitive series.
They are very competitive.
When you've got Strauss, Peterson, Bell, or sorry, not Bell, Pryor, yeah. In that side, you know, they're playing the home team. playing the home teams. It just gives it that extra edge, doesn't it?
There's always a lot of spice. I mean, the Ashes series is always very competitive, but the players kind of know each other a little bit better, or perhaps there's a bit more camaraderie in terms of the two sets of players, or at least that's the way I felt when I played them. In the South African series, there was always a bit of niggle. Yeah. You very rarely felt that you knew the guys on the opposition side very well. They're always quite sort of stone-faced and not particularly, you know, looking to kind of get to know you or come, you know, have a beer after the game, etc. And there was always a distance between the two sets of players, which led to some quite spiky encounters. Obviously, everyone will remember Atherton versus Donald in 98. There were blow-ups all the way through that series between certain players. I got involved in one. Then the following, you know, the return series.
Who did you get involved with?
I'm not telling you that.
Go on.
He's getting on a bit himself, actually, and he has the same initials as me. In fact, I've been mistaken for him on Twitter a few times.
Oh, he wears big gloves.
He wears big gloves. Yeah. there's always a lot of niggle, and I think that whole, you know, the KP trot thing in particular, that South Africa are very upset. Have always been very upset about the Kevin Peterson
jumping ship. Strange,
so
thing, isn't it? Yeah.
It won't be. It's not going to be friendly, which I mean, it'll be good viewing.
Why is there always that niggle?
Well, I don't know. I think you know, what was that song on Spitting Image? I've never met a nice South African. Maybe it's that.
You meant to say it's because we're so similar.
Yeah,
so
that's what it's like. It's like us and the Germans, you know. Exactly. We're very similar to the Germans, except everything works in their country.
Now, slightly friendlier waters, obviously, is a county season as well. Lancashire are the reigning Division 1 champions. I'm just wondering how we're seeing that going this year. Any tips for who might have the pennant come next September?
Yes, Mark? You know what, I have no idea. There are no clear favourites. I think 2 years ago, two or three years ago, you'd start at the beginning and just think Durham were too strong for everybody there. Their bowling attack, their experienced batters, a lot of overseas stroke sort of naturalised players, very experienced, etc., etc. But I feel that they've just gone over the crest of that. That Nottinghamshire were kind of like the coming team, but they've got their problems in terms of scoring enough runs. Lancashire, obviously, amazing achievement in the end with a side that, you know, if you look at some of the Lancashire teams that have been and gone over the last 20 years and the fact that they couldn't win a championship and then a relatively unknown bunch come and pull it off after 70 odd years is a, you know, that's a great effort from them. It would be an enormous effort for them to keep it up. So I think it'd be very open. You know, the two London teams have just come back up again. Middlesex,
a lot of people are picking Surrey, aren't they, because they've got good bowling attack.
I mean, they've got a very good bowling attack. The batting is still prone to sort of the odd 60 not out. They go out and try and give it a whack, and I think that's why they've decided to sign Jack Rudolph for the beginning part of the season. But yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be very, very open.
A question from the audience for Ian. Does cricket have a viable economic future at county level? I mean, how do you see it being played in 10 years' time?
God, the eternal question of county cricket's economics. I mean, I'd certainly say it's no worse than it's been in the last 20 years or so. If anything, you know, there's a certain amount of earning potential through 2020 that wasn't there that is feeding through. But the ECB have no choice but to keep county cricket alive, viable. You know, otherwise, where are they getting the players from? You know, it's always going to require a large subsidy. You're never going to get it through the gate. You're never going to require a huge TV audience for it. But what we've noticed ourselves for the past few years, since we started kind of the live blogging every day's play, where you'd send four people to four different grounds, and we've now got this wonderful little vibrant community online around county cricket. I mean, that for me is the kind of green shoots of revitalising a kind of a media's appreciation of a game in that digital age, whereby, you know, you're never going to get the mass market kind of figures for it you do through football, through test cricket, through Olympics or whatever, but there's enough kind of dedicated, enthusiastic people out there who are willing to come and almost make your coverage for you, which I very much feel the way we do county cricket now is far more to do with the readers than it is to do with the writers, you know, the kind of people who are willing to spend an hour or two on there every day, you know, telling what they've heard from down the road, you know, engaging with the writers who have to engage back. I mean, I think that's very much the future for kind of maintaining and growing the audience that's out there for county cricket. You know, and it's the wonder of the web is that it gives you the means to do that. Whereas, you know, if you were relying on what you get in print newspapers for your county cricket coverage these days, I mean, admittedly it's pretty thin gruel, and it's unlikely to get any better. We're all feeling the squeeze and kind of space and so forth. But I think, to go back to the question of finances, I think that I think the kind of really pessimistic outlook from a few years back, where the likes of England, Australia, South Africa could see only a future in, you know, where India was the only player in a huge landscape, and all the numbers were theirs, all the eyeballs were theirs. I think the outlook's a lot better than that now, you know. And I think the type of kind of blind panic that drove the ECB into the arms of Alan Stanford as a kind of defensive measure at the time, you just don't get any sense of that there now. And I don't think you don't hear the kind of really evil prognosis for no test cricket in 10 years' time that you were actually hearing around maybe 5 years ago. I mean, a lot of that has calmed down. I think most nations can see, you know, a way of balancing the books that will keep top level cricket going healthily, and that will therefore feed down to the county game that is, you know, the necessary requirement for international teams. So I don't think the outlook's that bleak at all.
It's an alarming image there, blind panic and in the arms of Alan Stanford, given
it was,
where
it,
he is
it,
right
it
now.
Was, yeah. It was nothing under that. If you think back...
Orange doesn't suit him, does it?
Yeah. If you think back to that time, that you know, that they were getting kicked right off the committees of the ICC, and the IPL had, I think, just been announced. You know, all they could see was millions upon millions upon millions into the arms of Jagmohan Dalmia to be dispensed as he saw fit. You know, and all they thought was, what can we do about this? Where do we get the cash? Along comes Stanford with a literal suitcase full of it. And it was
full of somebody else's.
Or somebody else's. And it was just too good to refuse. I mean, any amount of due diligence at the time would have told
Any one of us would have been taken in.
Any one of us, indeed. Yeah. So that's my Christmas card.
How do you think you got me here?
Another one for you, Ian. Do you see Ireland playing Test cricket within 5 years?
I mean, I see them with a capability to do it in narrow playing terms.
It doesn't count if they're playing in the England team, by the way.
I think there's a far greater chance of that. I'm really not sure. I think you've got to think long and hard before you make Ireland a Test playing nation. We were looking at some of the stats from the ICC Test Championship table before we come in here. Yeah. I think we got them right here. Bangladesh, who are bottom, have played 18 tests since this table started to be compiled, versus England's 41. Now, South Africa, who are second, have played 28 versus England's 41. There's huge disparities in this. I mean, do you really want to be encouraging Test cricket in a country that genuinely has very little culture of appreciating it? You know, aren't there far better testing grounds and new frontiers for cricket out there than Ireland, where with the best will in the world, you're never going to get more than 4,000 people at a test match in Ireland. It just doesn't have the following, doesn't it? You know, they're fine the way they're going, to be honest, and it's a great lark of the World Cup every few years, and you'd maybe like to see them brought into Champions Trophies and things like that. But one step at a time. I mean, they are a million miles away from having the kind of cricketing culture that should nurture a test team. Surely there's better options.
Other matters, I suppose it's, of course, almost IPL time, which starts next month. And I know, Mark, you wanted to talk a lot. Oh, actually, I'm just saying we've run out of time. So we won't have time to go there, unfortunately. What a shame. On that note, all that remains is to thank our studio guests. Thanks very much, Mark.
No problem. It's
been a pleasure having you. Thanks, Ian. And thanks, of course, to all the listeners and to the audience here in the studio. And thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.